In late October, John Paley received another horrific report from Switzerland. It contained firsthand testimony from three men who had managed to escape from Auschwitz and provided meticulous details of what they had seen there.
The board seized upon this. Now we had the eyewitness accounts.
Paley said the report ought to be required reading for the people of the United States.
The release of the Auschwitz report is headline news throughout the country. These news reports explaining to the American people what Auschwitz was and what happened there are followed up by op-eds, by columns about Auschwitz and what America has to do in the wake of all of this information.
And the fact that it's released by the War Refugee Board. It's not being released by a Jewish organization. It's not being released. Rabbi Stephen Wise says it's coming from a governmental source. It's much harder to dismiss it.
There's a poll in late 1944, and the question is asked, do you believe that Germans are murdering Jews in concentration camps? It runs in the Washington Post. 76% of Americans by that time believe that it's happening, but then they're asked the numbers, how many Jews do you think have been killed? And Americans cannot grasp the scale and the scope of the crime. It's only 1 in 5 Americans believe that it's more than 1 million Jews who have been murdered, and by that point it's more than 5 million.
From Florentine Films, a clip from the remarkable new film from Ken Burns, Lynn Novick, and Sarah Botstein, The U.S. and the Holocaust premieres Sunday night, the first of 3 nights on PBS. And Ken joins us this afternoon to talk about the making of the film and the story behind it. My gosh, Ken, I had such a visceral reaction to this film.
Yeah.
So many emotions, gutted with sadness and anger, shocked by the parallels that we see today, and ultimately inspired by, I guess, the strength of the human spirit. But it's a challenging film, but an absolutely remarkable one.
I'm so glad you feel exactly that way. That's the only way, I think, to describe it. You know, the combination of emotions that don't fit into neat compartments and the frustrations, and yet also the admiration for the heroic moments that shine through in humanity's darkest times. And then the kind of sense of obligation to ourselves that this is all sponsored by something that we see in our present day, which is anti-Semitism and racism and nativism. And there's really only one race, and that's the human race. And we are in this together, and our success will come from our progress. Is come from joining together, not making others of people. And the Holocaust is, of course, the most horrendous othering of a group of people you could imagine.
Well, the title of the film tells us what we're going to see here. It's not the story simply of the Holocaust, but in many ways, the failure of America to help out.
Yeah. I mean, look, we let's just say it. We did more than any other sovereign nation. But if we'd done 10 times as much as we did in terms of letting human beings trying to flee the horror of the Nazi regime, we still would have failed. And so this is, yes, about a monumental dark spot, but it's also a kind of dramatic story of how we got there. And it's interesting, almost paradoxical, it now feels to me in retrospect as we're looking at reactions to this film and seeing it with different eyes now that it's done, that by making it the U.S. and the Holocaust, it actually gives a fuller and kind of very understandable picture of what actually happened in the Holocaust, irrespective of the United States, right? What went on. But then filtered through American eyes, it gives us, you know, responsibility, skin in the game, if you will, but also a horrific sense of failure and responsibility for not having responded with the better angels of our nature, but responded more with the baser instincts that, you know, attend for most of human life anyway.
There's always been anti-immigrant fervor in this country. Here in Maine in the 1830s, we had anti-Irish riots, the Chinese Exclusion Act of the later 19th century. What was it that specifically led to the rise of anti-Semitism in America?
Well, it's the kind of the oldest hatred in the world, because until 1948, Jews were a people without a country. And so they benefited from seeing the world from a kind of different perspective, a less nationalistic one, one that would be less tribalistic, I guess, is the word. And as a result, they bring notions of the Golden Rule and of fair play and of civilization, if you will, to the various nationalities, the various tribal identities that made up the world. And often they would perform things that other people didn't, and they became convenient scapegoats for demagogues and authoritarians. And so it's always helpful. You can always pick out an authoritarian because they're blaming some group for something, right? And that's the whole idea of it. It's about grievance. It's about convincing your fellow citizens that are like you that the reason why things aren't perfect is because of these people. And so just across time, Jews have been subject to persecution after persecution. Obviously, nothing compares to what happened between 1933 and 1945. And so it's a story that has to be told. We have to understand that some of the elements, you know, that Americans are born with the same sort of impulses as well. Not all Americans, of course, but I mean, we have in our history racism and anti-Semitism and anti-immigrant sentiments, as you were mentioning, and also our treatment of Native Americans, and all of which was an important antecedent for us to then consider, you know, what happens when the Nazis take over, because it's not without precedent other places in the world. In fact, they study our Southern Jim Crow exclusionary laws against blacks to pass discriminatory laws against the Jews in Germany. And, you know, whenever we protested at the treatment of the Jews, they'd look at us and go, as the scholar Peter Hayes says in our film, Mississippi. One word, Mississippi. Like, you treat these people, you tell them and yourselves that they are inferior. That's all we're doing here. Why are you... This is the pot calling the kettle black kind of thing. And it's, you know, it's a very tough thing to understand.
I learned so much from this film, and I knew a little bit about eugenics, but I had no idea of the extent of the fact that, as is mentioned in the film, some 60,000 Americans were sterilized without their consent before the laws were changed. It's a harrowing story.
And Rich, the last laws went off the books in 2014, 2015. I mean, it's shocking. And this was something embraced by conservatives, but also progressives who saw a possible positive thing with eugenics, that you could help cure society of its ills. But when you hear who subscribed to it, like Theodore Roosevelt and, you know, Alexander Graham Bell, and universities and preachers and great philanthropists paid for it, and Helen Keller thought there, you know, you remember all the cuckoo hue and cry when the Affordable Care Act came up that there would be death panels. There was no such thing. There has not been such thing. But the Helen Keller quote ought to be shocking in the extreme in our film, because she, deaf, blind, and mute, is proposing panels of doctors that would decide whether a baby would live or die. And, you know, the unbelievable thing is that she would probably be chosen for that, for extermination, right? I mean, eugenics is something that was born in Britain, kind of popularized in the United States, and then I guess you could say that the Germans just took it and perfected it in the most ghastly and horrible way, with the experiment on children and handicapped people and others, you know, different religious, Jehovah's Witnesses, gay men, the Roma and Sinti people who were derogatorily called gypsies, just the endless experiment, and the Jews, you know. And it's just, there were 9 million Jews in Europe in 1933. And in 1945, two out of three were dead, murdered.
How much damage did the Johnson-Reed Act of 1924 do to the cause?
That's a wonderful question, Rich. It's central to understanding this. We'd had mostly open borders between, say, 1870, even before that, people just got on ships and came, mostly open borders, 1870 to 1920. And with the exception of the Chinese Exclusionary Act, which was in 1882, I believe, or 84, we hadn't really delineated anything. So the Johnson-Reed Act was basically an attempt to follow some of the language we hear today of extremists, of, you know, a worry that Protestants were going to be replaced, that there were these uncouth people coming. Just as you pointed out in the history of Maine, there was a time when the Irish were discriminated against, and Catholics of any sort were, and then there was an assimilation. Then you found another enemy to have. And so basically the Johnson-Reed Act sort of used eugenics in a way to suggest that there were superior races, and it created a quota system that basically favored Northern Europeans, what the Germans would call Aryans. This is all fiction, right? You understand this is all fiction. There's no, the biological distinction of race just does not exist in the way that people were trying to do it, categorizing different sorts of people. Human beings are human beings are human beings. And so basically they limited the quotas on the countries that would have more Catholics. Southern and Central and Eastern Europeans were excluded in favor of Northern Europeans. Scandinavians and Irish and British and Germans, and they were considered they were Protestant, and they were considered for the most part, and they were considered like desirable stuff, and so there it would equal the balance. And though the Johnson-Reed Act never named Jews, the countries that had the minuscule quotas were those with the largest population of Jews, like Poland and what is now Ukraine and Lithuania and Latvia and Belarus and Hungary and Romania, right? And so you've just got built-in discrimination, and then you have this gigantic humanitarian crisis, and there's nothing to be done. I do want to say an important thing. This was the law of the land in the United States. There was no way the president could say, hey, let these people in, let that vote in, let this pass. But during that time, the Johnson-Reed Act was neither expanded nor contracted. You know what I mean? They didn't relax the quotas. They tried to, and they didn't increase, you know, they didn't tighten the quotas. So it just was there as this monumental excuse, an obstacle for the United States to behave in a humanitarian fashion. And if you add to that all of the resentments that grow with economic dislocation, and in this case, the Depression, the greatest crisis, you know, economic crisis in the history of the world, you have people thinking, I don't want to let anybody in that's going to take my job, or at least that's what the demagogues would say. But you had prominent industrialists like Henry Ford promulgating just the most racist anti-Semitic tracts, taking the famous Russian hoax, the complete hoax called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, that was posited a kind of Jewish conspiracy to take over the world, just made up fiction and printed it and published in books, and it was translated into languages around the world, including German. I mean, it fired people up in a way that just exaggerated it. In the face of the Depression, you could have an anti-Semitic radio priest with an audience of millions, Father Coughlin from Detroit, talking about the money changers and, you know, all the code word for Jews that had been used, and all with kind of absurd, irrational fears. And, you know, and then you have somebody like Charles Lindbergh, who is, you know, arguably the second most famous person in America after President Roosevelt, who was a virulent anti-Semite and who became head of the America First, which was an attempt to keep the United States out of war in large measure because most of the people who ran it were very sympathetic to the Germans and thought there was no chance for Britain or any other democracy of Western Europe to survive. And they were kind of hedging their bets.
We're talking with Ken Burns on Downtown. You mentioned President Roosevelt, and that's an important part of the story. Historians, I think, have judged him pretty harshly for what was perceived as a lack of response. We learn in the film that he wanted to do more and did all he could, but was a bit hamstrung by not only the laws, but his own administration and the American public, whether it was groups like the DAR and the American Legion, or whether it was just public sentiment that felt badly for what was going on, but at the same time did not want to take more Jewish immigrants.
Yeah, Roosevelt's an interesting lightning rod, because I think you've got such a singular figure of evil on the other side in Adolf Hitler that people want to, even scholars want to, equate this. You know, Roosevelt was not a king. He had to operate under the Johnson-Reed Act. He could not do unilaterally some things. He wanted to do stuff. I'd fall halfway between the two descriptions. He could have done more. He could have shouted louder. But he was also working the machinery of government, knowing full well about the sentiments of the Congress, completely opposed to this, the sentiments of the American people, completely opposed to this, but knows that he has to spend his time working to revoke the Neutrality Act. And we look now from our position of superiority and go, well, you should have been dealing with this great humanitarian crisis. If he'd not been able to revoke the Neutrality Act, we might be speaking German. I mean, I'm not trying to joke with you. Mm. We made our film on World War II that came out in 2007. We interviewed a fellow who grew up in Waterbury, Connecticut, and he was Jewish, and he was in the liberation of Western Europe, and he was interviewing a German prisoner who was a bureaucrat who'd been sent into uniform. They'd run out of soldiers, and his job was to take over where this guy, our guy, Ray Leopold, lived in Connecticut. He knew Central Connecticut better than Ray Leopold knew it. He spoke perfect, unaccented English. And they had a cadre of people determined to take over every section of the United States. So if Roosevelt can't do the thing that he believes is the number one thing, to defeat this person, a lot of this other stuff is not moot. It's still an ongoing humanitarian crisis, but I don't want to let him off the hook completely. I want to say he could have done more. His wife is whispering in his ear. His wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, is right on just about everything, and she is trying desperately to have a much more, you know, to broadcast even further the atrocities of the Germans, and that may have helped. It may have, you know, given chances for more people to get out, but you don't know. It is a failure across the board, and we're all culpable. We're all responsible.
Roosevelt would tell supporters that the best way to rescue the Jews was to win the war. Yeah. But by 1942, when Edward R. Murrow was reporting on what was going on, when Gerhard Rigner shared what he had discovered, in many ways, was it already too late because most of the damage had already been done?
Well, let's see. Yeah. By the time we get boots on the ground in Italy, right, in 43, two-thirds to three-quarters of the Jews that are going to be murdered have been murdered. And by the time we have an air base in Foggia able to, say, make a bombing run to Auschwitz, there's a whole other question, too, whether you bomb Auschwitz mm-hmm. or whether you bomb the rail lines with our imprecise bombing, and whether you were willing to take the public relations hit that would come from learning that we weren't, our soldiers, our airmen were not dying in the service of the war, but in liberating Jewish death camp occupants, you know, it's a huge thing. But by the time we could get an airplane there, three quarters of the Jews in Europe who are going to be murdered have been murdered by the Nazi regime and their cohorts. So it is just one of those horrific things. I think the scholar Deborah Lipsett says in two different places in the film exactly right. First, she says the obvious. The time to stop a Holocaust is before it happens.
Right.
That's why we need to study this period. You just, you know, as Daniel Mendelsohn says in our film, don't kid yourself. This is possible. There is no bottom, he says, to human depravity. So So you just, you know, you have to guard against this. You have to protect your institutions. It has to be about civilization and not about the tribal instincts. But then very late in the film, Deborah says, maybe if we had yelled louder about it, and this is why I was holding Roosevelt's feet to the fire a little bit more than you were, is if we'd yelled louder about it, if we'd been able to get people out of those refugee cities like, you know, Lisbon or Casablanca or other places where the refugees could still get out once Hitler was the master of Europe, it might have been possible for us to save more people than we did. But, you know, this is not humanity's nor the United States, finest hour.
The testimony in the film of those who were there is so incredible. Guy Stern, who was sent to America alone at age 15, Saul Messinger, whose family tried to get out on the St. Louis, Susie and Joseph Hilsenrath, and his, I think, the most powerful moment of the film for me was his remembrance of seeing the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah. So, you know, in Hitchcock, they always, the students of Alfred Hitchcock's movies always said that he had what he called a MacGuffin, this thing, this object that recurs, that becomes the focus of something. In our film, three parts, 6 hours plus, our MacGuffin is the Statue of Liberty, the symbol we think of a country that welcomes immigrants, but also a symbol that many people also felt should guard against anybody coming in. So each one of the chapters, the three chapters, is named after a phrase in the poem by Emma Lazarus, the golden door being the first one. You know, the Statue of Liberty occurs and reoccurs throughout the film. And so one of the most important moments is that when Susie and Joseph Hilsenrath finally, they're sent by their parents alone to France to escape the trouble. The father then gets out and is able to get the mother and the baby infant son back out. And they're, you know, one step ahead of the Nazis in Paris and then in Versailles and then into Vichy, France. And then finally their father is able to get them out because he's in America. They come and they're on a boat out of Lisbon called the Serpapinta. And they were, you know, housed and they said, you can come up at 6 a.m. because we're going to come into New York Harbor. And the fog lifted Susie said, like the curtain at the opera. And then Joseph just describes it, and he breaks down, you know. And here you are looking at an old man who you're really actually looking at as a kid relieved that he will have a life ahead of him. And I think this is where we need to stop. When we say 6 million, it's an opaque number, Rich. We just, right. It doesn't mean anything. But if you take people, as Daniel Mendelsohn does, his great Uncle Shmuel Jaeger from a little provincial town in eastern Poland named Bolohov, and his wife and their four daughters, and he finds out what Daniel calls the particularities of their death. Only one died from gas. You go, what? What? Only one? How, you know, he discovers how each one of them died, and all of a sudden you begin to loosen a grip, and you begin to see that all of those people are like a missing limb. You know, that still itches, that still pains us, that we are aware of the lost potentiality of human life. What cure for cancer was not invented? What symphony wasn't written? What garden wasn't tended? What farm field didn't yield? What child wasn't raised with love? What was the next generation that's missing? That's what you have to do when you talk about this. If it's just about numbers, if it's just about the horrible, mangled, naked bodies with bulldozers, all you've done is kind of participated in a kind of Holocaust porn. But if you make people understand, these are human lives. I mean, one of the most poignant things, one of the last things we did is we added in three different places in the last two episodes, just letters from three different people who are basically saying what I'll give you one example of a letter. A guy writes to a friend and he said, I want you to have this letter because I want the world to know that someone named David Berger once lived. He knows he's going to his death and he wants to say what all human beings wake up and say, I am, right? And so it's really important for us, as we love to back the dump truck up and show the statistics and this and the 60 million killed or the 55 million killed and the 6 million Jews that were killed in the... These are all human beings whose lives were as important to them as ours are to us, and that we need to restore an essential humanity to their story and realize that the great crime of othering, of making someone who is seemingly slightly different from you other, is the mark. You know, I think I've even talked to you about this, Rich, before, that I realized that I had had the great privilege for the last 50 years of making films about the U.S., but I've also been making films about us. That is to say, the lowercase, two-letter plural pronoun, all the intimacy of us and all of the majesty and the complexity and the contradiction and the controversy of the U.S. And what I've learned over that half a century is that there's only us. There's no them. And if anybody tells you there are them, run away. There's only one race, and that is the human race. It's just where we began this conversation. That's it. The problems begin when we start making the distinctions. And there is a tyranny, not only for the person who is imposed on, but there is a trap for the people who believe this, for the conspiracy buffs, for the people who latch on to the protocols of the elders of Zion, or the people who think this or think that about other people or other parties or other things like that. And we have, as a democratic society, an obligation to protect the institutions that we've created over 245 plus years. You know, my last film was on Benjamin Franklin. And when the doors of the what is now Independence Hall, it was then the Pennsylvania Assembly, were thrown open after that hot summer of 1787, where all the compromises were made, some very tragic compromises for enslaved people in the United States, for Native people in the United States, for women. Nonetheless, you know, a woman whose rights were not respected walked up to Dr. Franklin and said, "What have you created, a monarchy or a republic?" And he said, "A republic if you can keep it." And those words mean so much now because of the great crises that we've been through, the Civil War, the Depression, and World War II. The greater crisis is right now, where the crisis of confidence in our own democratic institutions, manufactured by demagogues, very similar to other periods in history, but unprecedented in the United States, are threatening the very institutions. And Daniel Mendelsohn, who found his great uncle's story, and always and pursued it doggedly to give a face to 6 of the 6 million, says, don't kid yourself. You know, those people in the sepia pictures of long ago, we think, oh, they're not like us. They're exactly like us. And that, you know, anything can happen, and it becomes incumbent upon all of us to just work as hard as we can to project those better angels, to be members of the human race, and not to make a distinction of making somebody else the other.
As a history teacher, I've said to students for years that we have a short memory as people. This is not ancient history. We have people in our community who still bear the marks from their time as survivors in the camps. What do you hope young viewers take away from this film?
Well, you know, we're storytellers, and you'd never want a lecture, but I've spent my entire professional life, Rich, as you know, making films that go to PBS first. And in this case, also, we worked, you know, association with the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., who also has spent their entire existence trying to reach out to students as PBS. And so it isn't just the broadcast of the film that matters to us. It's the subsequent educational outreach that gives us a chance to tell these stories, particularly now as those survivors are dying away. Steven Spielberg's Shoah Foundation has 54,000 taped testimonies. God bless him for that effort. There's even a holographic record of some of those people in which you can go into certain spaces and ask them questions, and there's not a question that those holographic AI, it doesn't. You're sitting there looking at a survivor. But particularly now, as there's a resurgence of denial, as there's an upsurge in places that don't want to teach uncomfortable history. Well, right. Wait, if you're the most exceptional country on earth and you don't want to be toughest on yourself, how do you remain exceptional? Well, the answer is you don't. You don't. You become unexceptional if you're unwilling to face. I mean, if the coach loses 52-0 and says, we were terrific today, that coach doesn't last. He says, oh, we really sucked on defense and offense, and, you know, we turned over the ball 2 minutes. That you say this is who it is. We need to teach our history, and teaching about the Holocaust is as important as the accomplishment, say, of putting a man on the moon. Teaching the Holocaust and understanding the roots of racism and anti-Semitism and nativism and anti-immigrant sentiment around the world in the United States are as important as understanding the extraordinary achievements of the United States, of which there are many. And you could list them. I would say that for all its glaring mistakes, for all the problems that it has, I would defy someone to come up with another institution that has done, beginning with the Declaration, flawed as it was, the Constitution, flawed as it was, the Bill of Rights, the Land Grant College Act, the Homestead Act, the Transcontinental Railroad, the child labor laws, Social Security, labor's right to organize, the GI Bill, the interstate highway, the space program, the Affordable Care. I mean, these are extraordinary accomplishments that cannot be taken away and won't be taken away. But you do not diminish the vibrancy of the tapestry by lifting up and sweeping out some of the dirt and saying, this is also us too. I'm sure you were shocked to see me. I'm sure as a history teacher, you'd seen it before, the footage and the still photographs of thousands and thousands of Klansmen in full regalia marching down Independence Avenue in our Capitol or lining the steps, invited to the Capitol of the United States. This is a racist, a homegrown terrorist organization like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, right? And it expanded and grew in popularity because it was not just racist, but it was anti-Catholic, and it was anti-Semitic and anti-immigrant. So it enjoyed an unbelievable resurgence right after the First World War, just as the time we began to shut those golden doors and pass the Johnson-Reed Act, which would so severely limit the immigration that had once flown freely, allowed people from everywhere to come to the United States.
Well, Ken, thanks to you and Lynn and Sarah and everyone on the team for, I think, an incredibly important work. And thanks, as always, to you for talking with us about it today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you. It's very important to know this is not my film alone. The script by Jeffrey Ward is spectacular. And my co-director is Lynn Novick, who you referred to, and Sarah Botstein are equally responsible for this film. And thank you so much for giving me an opportunity to talk about it.